Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. Today we have a returning guest, which we're pleased to have, James Valiant, author of Creating Christ. And he's here with Mark and I to discuss Ayn Rand's essay, Faith and Force, the Destroyers of the Modern World. James, how are you?
I'm quite well. How are you, Blair?
Doing very, very good.
Excited. And you, Mark, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm looking forward to discussing this essay and, what's ever happened since it was first published and also her recording of her talk in the 60s.
Yeah. What's astonishing about this essay, it was given or published in 1960. That's 61 years ago. At that time, she described our time as the age of guilt. What did she mean?
Well, Ayn Rand believed that emotions were not just automatic given primaries, that they had a cause. And Ayn Rand was really a pioneer in understanding that. Ayn Rand also believed that philosophy, yes, dry, what most people think of as dry and mostly totally irrelevant and incomprehensible philosophy, and totally useless in many people's eyes, she regarded philosophy as the most important influence on an individual human being. The single most important influence. And she also, because of that, she regarded it as the single most important influence in human history, single most important cause of the events of human history. Humans must, in order to act, must know what they're doing, must think. It's a precondition, basically, of acting is to know what we're doing. And for human beings, that involves choice and that involves abstract conceptual thought. And the broader the abstraction, the more ground it covers. One of the reasons why religion has persisted, even in our scientific era, of the power of philosophy. People still need a philosophy. You know, we live in an age of high technology and advanced science, and the ethics, the philosophy that still rules our time is thousands of years old. Mm-hmm. It's basically an ethics that was designed for very ancient primitive people. We haven't caught up ethically. And this will have psychological effects. Ayn Rand was a great opponent of the ethics, the traditional ethics of Western civilization, probably best summarized, say, in Christianity, in the Sermon on the Mount, and altruism, the idea that human beings, really, standard of value, the standard of good, is to sacrifice yourself for others. And it's put in many, many forms. She called it altruism. And exactly defining it in that way as sacrifice avoids the confusion that most people have between altruism and simple benevolence. Ayn Rand did not make that confusion. In fact, she believed altruism made real benevolence impossible. On the other hand, altruism is a broad abstraction, and it will have a psychological impact. And we live in an age where self-sacrifice is extolled as the moral ideal. It still is, and people cannot live up to it. And the religious, Ayn Rand also points out that the basic justification for altruism has always been religion. And a lot of people, especially intellectuals, have let go of that religious metaphysics, if you will, the supernatural metaphysics, but they've retained altruism. And so guilt, coming back to the question, why is this the age of guilt? Well, the predominant, obviously individuals will vary from person to person, but guilt is a predominant emotion of our time, made necessary, in effect, by the unlivable ethics of altruism. Ayn Rand believed that the ethics of altruism had reached its dead end in her time and really had no other place to go because it lost its the only possible justification it ever had, mysticism. And this has left the world in sort of a tension. Intellectuals want to defend the ethics of altruism, but really have rejected reason, realizing, in effect, this is the psychological motive for the rejection of reason philosophically, so that they can get away with their ethics, the ethics of altruism. And altruism, of course, an irrational sort of altruism, which dominates our time, must result in guilt. It can't be lived up to. It is a form of self-abasement and self-contempt. Altruism and guilt go hand in hand. Ayn Rand is here talking about how altruism had reached in her time sort of a dead end and nowhere else, if you, in effect, to go.
We will jump forward to Joke. She had also a question and answers, but also at the end of her talk, she asked, and we'll probably come back to that because you did a great intro here, James. But she said the answers to the whole thing is about, you said, about altruism, and to the audience that you talk to, you should ask a question, why, about altruism. And now you have laid out this here, that it's they are clinging to this. It's not so much religion anymore in a way, and it wasn't it Comte that came up with...
Auguste Comte, yes, the French Comte. Philosopher was the one who coined the term. Otherism, literally.
Yeah, the otherism. But why she said you should ask the question why when somebody said you have to sacrifice or you should sacrifice something that for higher values.
Well, you have to ask yourself, I mean, why is sacrifice a value? Why is a piece of cake a value in your neighbor's stomach and mouth, but not in yours? Why is it really we exist for each other? No one actually exists for their own sake. You know, Ayn Rand described it as a sort of an exchange of Christmas presents that neither side really wants.
That's right. Yeah.
So the question is, if altruism is sacrifice, not benevolence toward your fellow man, but actual self-sacrifice, the giving up, the surrender, the abnegation of an important value, or ultimately yourself, why? Why? Mm-hmm. And as Ayn Rand points out, no earthly reason has ever been given for it. The ethics of altruism, the ethics that says, well, how do politicians in my country put it so often, to live or to surrender for something greater than your, to live for a cause greater than yourself. You know, I would be willing to risk my life for my freedom and for a society that had individual rights, because I know the importance of that to my own life. Yes. But that's because it's my value. If I were to give my life for the cause of freedom, please never, ever say I surrendered my life for a cause greater than myself. That was myself. That was my high value. That was worth it to me. So Ayn Rand looks at the whole thing quite differently. And when looked at that way, paying a high price for a high value to her is no sacrifice. It's paying the appropriate price. That's a question of the law of cause and effect, in effect. And so Ayn Rand believed that sometimes we had to pay the appropriate cost for our highest values, but she did not regard that as altruism. True altruism, to justify self-abnegation, self-sacrifice for its own sake, in effect. Well, Christianity was outdone at the end of the Enlightenment by German philosopher Immanuel Kant.
Yeah.
And Ayn Rand identifies that philosopher as the main causal fountainhead, the wellspring, if you will, of a sort of new and virulent form of self-abnegation, an even worse sort of construction of altruism than even Christianity or primitive religions had ever offered. And Immanuel Kant, in effect, set out in the midst of the Enlightenment. Ayn Rand observes that since the Renaissance, religion had really lost its power. And science and a secular philosophy was sort of taking hold in the West. It was filled with errors, the errors of rationalism and empiricism that commenced modern Western philosophy. But Immanuel Kant was worse than any of them. He, in effect, saw religion as under assault in his Age of Enlightenment, and he was absolutely correct. And he set out quite self-consciously to defend not Christianity's supernaturalism, in effect, but its worldview, its ethical stance, its emotional position, its sense of life. And so, in effect, the Christian sensibility is what he explicitly set out to defend. And in order to do that, he had to define ethics as something that had absolutely nothing to do with human life. The technical term in philosophy is deontology. A deontological as opposed to a consequentialist approach to ethics. And what that means is consequences don't matter. To Kant, the outcome of your action is really irrelevant to its moral character or quality. And he was focused in a tremendously rationalistic way on trying to understand the abstract requirements of what ethics would require. And in doing that, he set out the test that said, if you have a personal interest, if you have a personal desire or inclination then that robs you of your ability to even say that your action has any moral character, whatever.
Wow.
At all.
Yeah.
So Kant set out a test that made any benefit to your own life irrelevant, or worse than irrelevant, to ethics itself. Sort of an anti-egoism. Cutting at the root, what Ayn Rand's great achievement in ethics was to establish the relationship between ethics and human life. Between the consequence of life and death and adhering to moral principle. So what Kant was doing was cutting out at the root any possibility of objective ethics, and certainly anything like Ayn Rand's objectivism.
You mentioned the word deontology or deontological, and I've heard of ontology. Is that the same thing, or are there no. variants?
Well, it is linguistically related.
Okay.
Ontology is a very technical term in philosophy, the science of being. The signs of existence as such. Deontology, well, without getting into the complex technical linguistics there, the two terms are related, but what he's saying is it has nothing to do with, in effect, results, consequences here on Earth, existential consequences, put it that way.
So, I mean, again, when you look at our documents, our founding documents, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, yet tied to self-sacrifice. That's the fundamental contradiction, I guess, of Western thought.
It is. It is, it is, it is. And it goes all the way back to a conflict between, in effect, a Greek, especially an ancient Greek, especially an Aristotelian perspective on philosophy, versus the mystical philosophy of something like Christianity, which owed a lot to another Greek, Plato.
Yeah,
no question about that.
Right.
But in effect, the battle has been between mysticism and reason. And since Aristotle established the basic rules of reason, how we know, to know one must look, one must observe. The observed world is what we're trying to figure out. And reason, logic, is our only means of doing so. And once reason, humanity's only real method of knowing anything, was self-consciously identified by the ancient Greeks, it's been a more self-conscious battle. And the Dark Ages were dark precisely because they rejected this Aristotelian naturalist and, by the way, implicitly egoistic worldview that Aristotle had in favor of a supernaturalistic worldview that could support altruism. The real motive behind all this supernaturalism was to support this otherwise unjustifiable ethics of altruism so that they could get away with, in effect, collectivism, a politics that imposed sacrifice on people from the government down. Now, as Ayn Rand observes, reason has been dominant and religion in retreat, in effect, since the Renaissance. That is, until Immanuel Kant resuscitated irrationality and altruism, in effect. And the collectivism, she notes, also faced a crisis in the middle of the 20th century between communism and Nazism. Even the failure of British socialism, democratic socialism, which became known by the middle of the 20th century, socialism's failure, the great failure of socialism, I mean, on a cosmic scale, the death of millions and millions of people, sort of made collectivism a questionable idea too. So while they no longer had sort of a supernatural worldview, they still needed to assault reason in a more sophisticated philosophical way in order to justify altruism, in order to justify their politics.
Yeah. Now, getting back to Kant just for a moment, I think the little bit I've read of him, because it's quite complex.
Yes.
I don't dare to read him because I'm not a professional philosopher. You have to have double bookkeeping there, Blair.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's the best. That's a very good way to put it. But I think what I noticed and what I did read is the word duty, and it keeps conjuring up the heel clicking, goose stepping form of I will do what I'm told.
Sacrifice for the state. Ayn Rand observes that most people cannot do some act consistently in a way they don't believe is morally correct. Morality is what will shape our emotions, our values. Abstract values will shape our emotions, and our emotions will be the main wellspring for most people's behavior. It's hard to act against what you believe to be morally good because your emotions are screaming at you, this is the right thing to do. How does Hitler get the masses to obey him to the point of cooperating with the invasion of Poland or the invasion of France and the rounding up of all the Jews into concentration camps and then all the Poles and communists and atheists? Well, how does that happen? Because people believe it's morally correct. Because Adolf Hitler could say, sacrifice for the fatherland. Sacrifice for the Volk, for the people.
The Aryan race, yeah.
For the Aryan race. The crudest form of collectivism, actually. Oof. Racism, as Ayn Rand observes here. So you're right. The whole Kant is what unleashed Hitler and Stalin. Dr. Leonard Peikoff has written a magnificent book, The Ominous Parallels, in which, to my satisfaction, he demonstrates that as just the simple historical reality. The influence of Immanuel Kant on all subsequent philosophy has been unmatched by any other philosopher. Even in its negative, reactive forms, they were all, in some sense, keying off of Kant's attack on reason.
Again, that book should have been, that should have sold 100 million copies.
Yeah.
But hey, we don't live in that world, sadly.
The world in which when I went to New York University to get a degree in philosophy, I had to read large excerpts from Kant's A Critique of Pure Reason and his prolegomena concerning future morals. I had to read a bunch of that stuff. Dense, unreadable. If you do figure it out, it's a nightmare. And that's the whole trick to it. People think it's sophisticated. You know, most people just tune out. Their eyes glaze over. And they regard the whole topic of philosophy as basically pretty much useless. But the exact opposite is true.
And he had the stomach also, as Rand said, to call it pure reason. And that's like the cover-up.
Yeah.
Cover-up the dirt. So
pure reason.
And please continue, Blair, with the question. But also we will maybe tie in here the historical, as we said, when it happened and what's going on today. And also the audience that she had. So please continue, Blair.
Sure. James, I did send you the list of questions, and I do want to cover why have three of humanity's greatest achievements, the Industrial Revolution, the United States, and capitalism, why have they been overlooked, ignored, or denounced?
Worse, denounced. Denounced for the great value that they impart to humanity. Consider, Ayn Rand observes that the Industrial Revolution was only the result of a freeing of the economy, a recognition of individual rights, including property rights, individual freedom. What that set off was an economic and technological revolution, the Industrial Revolution. And it changed, I mean, on an anthropological scale, it changed humanity, the way we live, the way we work, the amount of leisure time we have, the amount of the population that we can support, many times greater, as Ayn Rand observes. The ordinary American today lives better than Louis XIV of France could have ever possibly imagined, much less some Roman emperor or Egyptian pharaoh, simply because, I mean, think of modern shampoo and toothpaste and the quality and variety of entertainment. Forget medicine. But the food, clothes, and air conditioning and telephones and computers now available, unknown to the past. And the ordinary American lives better than the wealthiest pharaoh of any previous era. And that's all occurred within the last two or three centuries.
Yeah, now, again,
that achievement has, you'd think that that would be the screaming headline from all the humanities departments. Let's try and figure out the glorious achievement here. This great breakthrough. Instead, it is ignored. It is attacked as selfish. It is attacked as materialistic. Why? Altruism.
Yeah.
Capitalism is about fulfilling your life here on Earth. The only way to justify. See, you quoted the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
Even though egoism wasn't really set on a strong footing, just look at that line. The right to pursue your own individual happiness. An implicit kind of egoism was built into the moral justification for American liberty and American capitalism from the start. The only way to justify capitalism is by defending selfishness.
Yeah.
In principle, egoism is the only way. Altruism will always destroy. In fact, that's part of its motive, to control people, to justify the power of the state. And so you say, well, why is does capitalism in America, are they denounced as opposed to being praised as the breakthroughs in human history that they really were? Well, altruism. Altruism justified by mysticism. This attack on civilization, this attack on humanity that you really can see in the virulent forms of leftism today, such as environmentalism, stridently anti-humanity, stridently anti-civilization. That's why.
Yeah, I'm speechless because I'm staggered by the contradiction is so complete. I mean, there has to be, this is the only way out.
The 19th century saw slavery wiped out in civilized countries.
Yes, yeah, again, but they don't. They harp on it's still, you know, we're systemically racist.
The middle class, the development of individual freedom, a vibrant culture. She points out that even just the popular literature at the end of the 19th century in popular magazines, adventure stories or Sherlock Holmes mysteries or something, an elevated level that is today even unknown.
Boy, where do I go on from there?
About the so-called intellectuals, maybe, Blair?
Yes, sure, yes.
The irrationality, the overt, systematic irrationality of Kant. Kant's complete separation of ethics from any human interests, whatever, were the philosophical bases for the destruction, for the first, the failure to appreciate the Industrial Revolution and capitalism in the 19th century, and the dictatorship, the recoiling from individual freedom that occurred in the 20th century, the rise of totalitarianism and socialism that characterizes the 20th century.
Yeah, can you relate more of that to what we see daily here in America, let alone the world? I mean, just since Biden has only been in office, what, 75, 80 days? I mean,
yeah,
just incredible reversal.
One thing I have to say, it's not only in the speech, but in the question and answer period following the speech, she emphasized that collectivism, the crudest form of collectivism, is racism.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a perceptual level, you know, it's for the truly simple-minded perceptual level, you know, color and physical characteristics are what you go by, truly anti-mind approach to judging people. But in effect, that's what's left. Mysticism, overt irrationalism, and altruism leaves us with is sort of this crude collectivism, this tribalism that is the only thing that's left. She called that, did she not?
Mm.
Man, it is only worse today. She said that if you try to enforce by means of government either the racism that the American South had tried to impose under Jim Crow or a forced kind of integration, all you're going to do is impose racism itself and create more racial resentment and tribalism, which is exactly what has happened in the course of my lifetime.
Yeah. Well, that's why she said faith and force are corollaries. I mean,
right.
You know, they go hand in hand.
They must. See, this goes to really the heart of the essay and one of the key principles, fundamentals in Ayn Rand's own justification for freedom. In Ayn Rand's view, human beings should have their rights respected, should have their freedom respected. Why? Why should people be free? Animals don't need freedom. Animals treat each other by physical force. We have to treat animals with physical force. Why? Well, because we can't reason with them. We can't persuade them. There's no option to physical force, i.e. persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
Because human beings can persuade one another, that is the way we must deal with one another. In other words, go back to an even more fundamental issue. Our basic tool of cognition, the only way we have of knowing is reason. And reason can only operate in the real world if people are free. If you're free to use your judgment, I'm free to use my judgment. If someone points a gun at us, suddenly, Blair, your reason is irrelevant. My reason is irrelevant. The only mind that matters is the guy with the gun. Mm-hmm. And force can only shut down the operation of the mind. The mind is by nature a creative faculty and must be free. You must be free to disagree or you don't have freedom of speech. You must be free to act in a way that people think is wrong or you really don't have freedom of action and the economy will stagnate. I learned that freedom was the basic condition for the operation of reason, which is humanity's most basic tool of survival.
Yeah, one of the great things she said, and I'll have to paraphrase from memory, a lot of people can agree on a lot of things, but it's the right to disagree that must be protected from force.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Persuasion is what will guarantee the most rational outcome. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm free to reject your argument or your product on a free market or a free market of ideas, we can't really, you know, even John Stuart Mill, Ayn Rand didn't have terribly much respect for the utilitarian who tried to defend individual liberty in the midst of the 19th century. And his failure to really defend it really was what helped generate British socialism, as she points out.
Wow.
But even John Stuart Mill, yeah, but I mean, Bertrand Russell, for example, was the godson of John Stuart Mill, no less. Socialists were very inspired. Well, Mill himself, at the end of his life, turned socialist. Very sad. In any event, Mill, in his better days, pointed out that truth itself is served by allowing the wrong the loudest voice possible. Freedom of speech. Unless the guy who's mistaken is free to articulate his mistake, we'll never get past it.
He'll never learn. Yeah.
Right. Operation of reason itself, which is the source of all human progress, which is the humanity's basic tool of cognition and survival, requires freedom. And that's why societies comparatively prosper.
I mean, there's been very few periods of history where reason has dominated. You know, say, what is it, ancient Greece, the Renaissance, the founding of America.
Enlightenment really was the climax. The 18th and 19th centuries really was just a breakthrough on so many different fronts for humanity, artistic, political, scientific, even understanding politics to some degree. When you look at what the development of a country like America or the British rule of law, due process and rule of law in Great Britain, that is an astonishing, I mean, it's no accident that the scientific, technological, economic, political, artistic revolution is occurring at that time. And it is no accident that the 20th century recoiled from it. And the cause has a name, Immanuel Kant.
Yeah. Do you see any revival of Aristotelianism in culture and or the universities? Or, I mean, I know that objectivism has a toehold in a few places.
Well, even sort of a neo-Aristotelianism, I mean, let's face it, philosophy had sort of reached a total bankrupt, dead end.
Yeah, no kidding.
In the 20th century. I mean, the linguistic analysis and the logical positivism, you know, the assault on just sensibility, making any sense at all, just becomes gibberish, had really reached its climax, and a sort of neo-Aristotelianism did slightly begin to take hold. You can see it in some non-objectivist academics. I would, you know, point out one of them, Ayn Rand herself admired, John Herman Randall. There's a bunch of intellectuals who sort of revived certain specific ideas that Aristotle had. I would think Personal Destinies by Professor Norton, Princeton, came out in the 70s, sort of a development of Aristotle's eudaimonia, happiness approach to ethics, egoism.
What is that book called? Personal Destinies.
Yeah.
Never heard of it. I'll have to get it.
There are some neo-Aristotelian authors who are worth checking out. Let me put it that way. But no one has really defended Aristotle and in a systematic way constructed a neo-Aristotelian philosophy that is as viable and as comprehensive and as well-grounded as Ayn Rand did. and is getting a toehold. There is a division of the American Philosophical Association, the Ayn Rand Society, devoted, and it's PhDs and professors who belong to it. And there's a growing number of those, which is a really good sign. And there's also a growing number of people influenced by Ayn Rand who are producing art and literature. Or I put myself in there. My book on history is not objectivism, but it is only made possible by objectivism.
Right. True.
So it's that kind of thing that will develop a culture that can turn it around, and only turning around of the entire culture from philosophy and culture up can really save the day.
Right. Now, I've got a bit of a left curve I want to throw at you. So are you sitting down? We talked about the age of guilt. In what way is that related to her other essay, The Age of Envy?
Oh,
I mean, my guess is they both obviously spring out of altruism, yeah, self-sacrifice.
Absolutely. Envy, she, interestingly, didn't define envy simply as a sort of jealousy, or even like Nietzsche did, a kind of resentment, although that's getting closer. She went all the way. She understood that envy was simply the hatred of a value, the hatred of the good for being the good. And that is the perversity we really see in our time.
Yes, it is.
You know, she has that in this essay, the Faith and Force essay, she has this most amazing line that really characterizes the culture of our time. As you say, the grotesque spectacle of militant uncertainty, crusading cynicism, dogmatic agnosticism, boastful self-abasement, and self-righteous depravity. It is that kind of paradoxical bankruptcy that is the necessary result of an attack on reason and the defense of altruism. Envy is closely related, in effect, to guilt, isn't it? They're both, in effect, assaults on a man's self-esteem, fundamentally, aren't they? They're both fundamentally emanating from a place of saying your life isn't an end in itself, is an unworthy goal. Your life and happiness is insufficient warrant for your behavior. Until and unless you do live for a cause greater than yourself, Blair, you are not a moral agent.
Oops. Hey, listen, I want to go back to that age of guilt again. When we last had you on, already back in November, unbelievably.
Oh, like just yesterday.
I know. But I was in a Bible study course, and I was coming to the end of, you know, the double bookkeeping that I could tolerate. And what drove it over the edge for me was all the groveling and the, you know, the self-abasement that these grown men were doing. And I just couldn't take it anymore. I just couldn't take it.
Ayn Rand, I think, is a little kind to Christianity. I think that America,
perhaps too kind.
Yeah, well, I think that certain American Christians gave her a very benevolent. I think she was familiar a little bit with Christianity as a doctrine. She does quote the Golden Rule, for example, here. She doesn't quote some of the more pernicious aspects of the New Testament and Christian doctrine. Love your enemy. Submit to the evildoer. Turn the other cheek to any aggression. In other words, you can't run away even. You can't block the punch. If you think you can win, you can't fight back. No, you've got to stand there and offer the other side of your face. Total submission to aggression and a submission to the evildoer, a submission to your enemy. And if you say love your enemy, you have in effect destroyed the concept of love. If love is not a positive preference, if love does not involve high selectivity based on positive values, then you have destroyed the very essence of the concept of love.
Yeah. Let's take the last few minutes before we hit our mark to come back to the current events. I'm going to borrow, I'll say friends of ours from the UK. They recently asked, why can't Israel defend itself properly? Or I'll add properly. I mean, it's just this nitpicking back and forth and back and forth. And then, oh, we Israel has to go to the peace talk table and surrender, or, you know, why? Again, why? Why can't they just take care of business?
The Hamas has said it wants to destroy Israel and drive every Jew and Israeli out of the region. And, oh, well, ooh, you're going to compromise with that? They don't even recognize Israel's right to exist, and they're supposed to deal with them? No, Israel, so with those missiles coming over, Israel has a right to wipe out Hamas. Wipe them out. They, you know, I learned a great lesson from my brother when I was a small child. I was, you know, like a little brother, 4-year-old brother, you know, and I was punching my older brother, who's only 5 or 6. And he turned to me and he said, you know, I'm going to let you get away with that just once this time. But next time I'm going to hit you back. And when I hit you back, I'm bigger and older. I'm going to hit you back 10 times harder. Boy, that left an impression on my little mind. And I was wary thereafter. And Israel has every right to hit Hamas 100 times harder than they are being hit. That's that. Enough force to stop it forever.
There it is. There it is. And James, Martin, do you have anything to add or you want to talk about? Or
yes, I want to put in a positive note here, in a way.
Yes, please do.
And I would say, but it's going back to the 60s, then. What would happen if this talk that she did in the 60s, or some other intellectual would do in her capacity, if that's possible to find? How would that, if you do deliver that at the university, because it was, she went to different universities and had talks, and this one that was recorded, it was to young Republicans at Purdue. How do you pronounce that? Purdue?
Yeah.
Purdue, yeah.
Could you imagine that?
I'm sorry?
James?
Could you imagine that, James?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. If only, well, you know, we do have people like me, and I am trying my best to channel all of the rationality and passion of Ayn Rand that I personally can. And so I'm trying to keep that spirit alive. But yeah, in 1960, Ayn Rand had not yet published any of her nonfiction books. It was just a few years after Atlas Shrugged, her last novel had come out. And she gave this talk at several universities, Yale, Columbia, you know, some of the best universities in North America. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, young Republicans too. And this it was really one of the formative, you know, most basic covering of the waters. And that's why I think this is really one of her most important essays. Here she's in a general way explaining her position on things and connecting the dots on a lot of her ideas. Interestingly enough, it was the first nonfiction essay by Ayn Rand that I ever read. After, you know, I read The Fountainhead first, then Anthem, I was blown away, knew I needed time to absorb that. But when I digested that sufficiently, I went on to Atlas Shrugged. And, you know, The Objectivist published these essays and speeches in pamphlet form. And the pamphlet of this speech was, I think, the only nonfiction that my school library had by Ayn Rand. So I knew I was going to set it aside and read it after Atlas. Well, after reading Atlas, I needed time to process Atlas. But when I finally did process it, the first nonfiction was this. And what an excellent introduction to her nonfiction this really is.
Thanks, Martin. Anything else?
No, I'm all good.
James, do you want to give us an update on what's happening with your book and Creating Christ as far as audio, video?
Well, it's available in all formats and it's selling very well. You know, over a year ago, award-winning documentarians approached us about making a documentary based on Creating Christ. And they had begun to undertake it when, of course, the COVID lockdown hit and, in effect, shut down most activity in this country. And so last year, the documentary production was delayed tremendously. But it's back on track as of now. And we expect that in about 8 to 10 months, there should be a multi-part documentary series based on my book, Creating Christ, interviewing leading scholars in the field, like Dr. Robert Price and Professor Robert Eisenman. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Congrats and great news. So thanks again, James, to doing this appearance.
Always my pleasure,
guys. And we'll talk soon again.
Yes.
All right. Well, James Valiant has been our guest today, and we appreciate him manning the foxhole with us. Take care, James.
You guys too.